This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. This is episode 149 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we?
Hi, David. Great. And we have a fantastic interview that you recorded this episode.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I'd like to thank NASA for the ability to have the interview. Who we're going to talk to is Frank Jones, who is the Research Service Deputy Director. And what we will be talking about is their Cirrus R-22 as a UAS testbed, as well as we talked about in the last couple of weeks, the Flirty hexacopter being installed into the Smithsonian Institution because of its pharmaceutical delivery to Western Virginia. Well, NASA Langley had a big part in that, and one of the initial deliveries was using their SR-22 as a surrogate UAV to fly the medications to the outskirts so Flirty could do the final delivery with the UAVs, as well as the testing that they've been doing for Sense and Avoid in North Dakota. I was very fortunate. I got to see the UAV lab, which some people would say looked a little bit like a hobby shop with a lot of radio-controlled airplanes, but their radio-controlled airplanes were a lot more sophisticated. And we can put some of those pictures in the show notes. But Frank was a wonderful host, so I guess we should just take it away. I'm here enjoying my afternoon at Langley Research Center. I'm here with Frank Jones. We're going to talk about Sense and Avoid and ADSBs and medical deliveries and integration into the national airspace. Frank, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Dave. I'm currently the Deputy Director for the Research Services Directorate. And the Research Services Directorate, we provide services to all our scientists and researchers here on the center at NASA Langley. We can integrate instruments on aircraft. So we our services that we provide are aircraft services, aircraft UAS, as well as large simulator services. So a scientist might come to us and say, I would like to put an instrument package on an aircraft and go fly it in, let's just say, Greenland. Then we have the ability to take that instrument, put it on the aircraft safely, evaluate all of the risks associated with flying what they want to fly, and then go operate that aircraft with instrument in Greenland. So I've been doing this about 10 years. Before that, right, so as a young buck out of Purdue University, I took a co-op job at what is now called Armstrong Flight Research Facility. And what's interesting is in those days, one of the first things I worked on was something called the HIMAT. It's still sitting in the Smithsonian. It is a remotely piloted vehicle that could do 9 G's sustained maneuver at Mach 0.9. So it was one of the first times that we were looking at high-performance drones, if you will. So luckily, I have had that experience in my background. I also, at the time, got to work on aircraft, the X-29, if you want to look at that. It was a forward swept wing that we were looking at the advanced technologies for fighter aircraft at the time. From there, I got the great opportunity to spend about 5 years working on space station, the space station program office in Reston, Virginia, which at that time was a real opportunity for me to understand the space side of the house. From there, went to headquarters for a few years, working in. I went back to working in aviation, where we began putting together advanced subsonic technology programs that later became the aviation safety program. At that point, I transferred to NASA Langley. I've been here now for about 15 years here at NASA Langley.
Let's talk about NASA's SR-22. And when I was here 5 years ago for the air show, I interviewed Nancy Chittenden, and we talked about the SR-22, and you were just starting doing sense and avoid technology with it. Where are we as far as sense and avoid technology? It's a big deal for all of our commercial UAV operators. They want ADS-B and they want safety, and we don't want, and anybody who's serious about this industry is concerned that we don't want, as you said earlier in our pre-conversation, metal against metal. So tell us a little bit about the sense and avoid program.
The sense and avoid issue is a difficult topic because you've got multiple aircraft, and where you're going to fly a UAS, a quadcopter moving at, 5, 10 knots is different than a jet UAS or a jet drone flying at 300 knots. And if you're flying in the airspace against other traffic, and you could be flying against a general aviation aircraft that's moving at 100 knots, or you could be flying against a jet aircraft that's flying at, 400 or 500 knots. Those are all different problems, all different situations, and require different sense and avoid capabilities. So where is the industry? I don't know that I'm the best person to ask that question, but I can give you where I believe they are. There are a lot of other folks who are down in the dirt and have been for years in the sense and avoid technologies. Currently, the FAA is planning to make ADS-B a capability, a required capability in the airspace system in 2020. So we have done some tests and evaluations on using sense and avoid software packages that required ADS-B technology information in, right? So the ADS-B is a transponder that basically sends out a message to other airplane to say, this is where I'm at. This is my location. It sends out a GPS location saying, I'm at this longitude, latitude, and this altitude. And so if I have a sense and avoid capability on my aircraft to say, hey, there's somebody over here, and he's moving at this speed, and I'm sitting where I am, then I can take that, calculate where I need to maneuver to stay out of his way. And so we did that kind of research using, as you mentioned, the SR-22. Why was the SR-22 a good package or a good aircraft? It's a Cirrus SR-22 that we modified roughly about 7 or 8 years ago. We took the aircraft and we have general purpose computers on board that interface with the aircraft in order to get all of the aircraft information it can. All of the state information, where are you at, and what other traffic is out there. So what we did is there's a general purpose computer on board where we stuffed these algorithms on there that would do the see and avoid, that would say, okay, I want to stay 2 miles away from this aircraft, and I'm going to calculate a maneuver to stay out of the way of the other aircraft. So the first time that we know of that was a test of this significance, we went up to North Dakota with University of North Dakota, MITRE Corporation, Draper Labs, and NASA. We all went up there. Several of those folks took three or four different algorithms, and we put them on board the aircraft, and we flew one aircraft against another. And so one other thing I need to mention about the SR-22. The SR-22 is a surrogate UAS. It's a surrogate drone. We have the ability to fly that aircraft from an onboard computer, from a person in the back seat, or from the ground. So that aircraft can actually be controlled from a software algorithm on the ground in a local area. So it made a great platform to go up to North Dakota and fly one algorithm or fly the aircraft against another aircraft and let the algorithms control the aircraft to make sure it did the sense and avoid, that it would see the other aircraft and avoid the other aircraft. So in North Dakota, we flew, the first time we went up, we probably had 400 different maneuvers where we flew the aircraft at the other aircraft, and it took us a while to get all of the algorithms working. What works in a computer in the simulation doesn't always work in the real world. And so we have to figure out that integration process to go from simulators to real aircraft. And that's why you do the flight validation.
You then improved the process and went back to North Dakota, my understanding.
Yes, so we did. So we flew in North Dakota the first time just trying to get the algorithms to work. Did ADS-B work? Could we do this? So the first time we went up there, we recognized that we finally got to a place where we spent 2 weeks developing the system, and we were able to make these algorithms work to some level of accuracy. The next year, we went back, and we actually, since we had the algorithms working, people went back home, they did their modifications to the algorithms, and we showed up there again a year later. And we were actually trying to break the algorithms. So we were trying to say, okay, what's the most difficult maneuvers we could perform? What's the most difficult positions we could put these algorithms in and see if they worked? So we would do what were called blunder maneuvers, where one aircraft immediately turned in front of another aircraft, and we wanted to see if the SR-22 running in a UAS surrogate mode would actually be able to maneuver and keep from, you know, running into the other one. And I say that, and I don't want it to sound dramatic, like we had our safety procedures so that we weren't going to let aircraft hit each other, right? So the SR-22 has a safety pilot on board who can click off the automation or the autonomy and take over control if he thought it was unsafe. We also, we were flying the aircraft at least 500 feet above the other aircraft in order to keep from hitting them. And we just fooled the algorithms to think that they were on co-altitudes. So we added safety procedures to make sure we never ended up with metal on metal. But the second year, we went back and we tried to break the algorithms. We tried to find the vulnerabilities within the algorithms. And that was really not saying that those algorithms that we were using are going to be the ones that do the see and avoid in the future. They were the initial cuts. They were the initial things. We were trying to find out what more we had to do to these, the software and the hardware, in order to make a system that we're all going to trust when we finally let UASs fly in mixed traffic.
And last summer, the SR-22 participated in something kind of revolutionary, which was the medical package delivery.
The UAS industry and the communities out there, they're trying to get drones out there to the point that they can use them for different package delivery, right? So we were approached by Virginia Tech to see if we wanted to participate with a company called Flirty in a delivery of medical supplies. And the concept was a drone aircraft flying from a long distance would bring a medical package to a airport, and then a drone, a small drone, that like a quadcopter, would then carry the medical package the last mile. So we were approached. We said, this is exactly the types of things we should be involved with to help create the safety case for that type of scenario. Begin collecting the data, understanding the policies, the procedures, and the system requirements for doing that kind of concept. That's why NASA thought it was something important to do. NASA Langley agreed to allow us to participate, and we physically flew the aircraft from about 40 miles away from one airport. We took our command and control system, right? So basically, we're using VHF radios on the aircraft, and we take a VHF radio hooked up to a ground computer, and we were able to control the aircraft from the ground roughly at about 40 miles away. So the aircraft took off from one airport 40 miles away. We controlled the aircraft to another airport, and then the aircraft would land. The medical supplies were offloaded, and then somebody took the medical supplies over to the Flirty team, and then they put the medical supplies on the quadcopter drone, and that drone flew those medical supplies to patients in need that were being treated as part of the remote area medical activity at Wise County, Virginia. So it was a great partnership with Wise County, Virginia Tech, Remote Area Medical, Flirty, all of those folks came together, and people were actually treated with the medical supplies that were delivered. So the concept, right, is in emergency situations. Can we use drones to deliver
roads are out.
Medical?
The roads are out. We got to get the meds to someone
who needs help.
One of those great uses, when we started the podcast about UAVs, I was sick and tired of seeing every news article with the word drone, and there was a picture of a Predator or a Reaper firing a Hellfire. And we set out a goal was the positives of UAVs. And that's a perfect application of a use for quadcopters and octocopters and delivery of medical supplies to remote places. We've seen that now overseas.
In Wise County, which is a very remote area of Virginia, and if you look it up on the map, there are roads. It's a very treacherous terrain area. So, and we discussed the fact that during the winters, the roads are snowed in and you can't get people there sometimes 3 or 4 days. A big rainstorm comes and the roads are closed because of trees and power lines down. Just having drones that could surveil those areas or deliver the insulin that somebody might need. There are a lot of elderly folks in that area as well, and getting just making sure that they're okay or delivering those medicines. That's an important thing that the current, first responders out there spend a lot of time trying to accomplish, making sure that their community is safe.
So what's our next steps for your program with Sense and Avoid and the SR-22, since she's been chugging along now for...
We're creating an urban test environment here at NASA Langley, and the idea is to be able to fly small UASs, the 25-pound or less UASs, and eventually get to a 55-pound or less UASs across our campus, to use them in our operational day. So we've started with, we've got an area that we call the Back 40. It's 40 acres. It's relatively there's not many folks back there, and it's not heavily used. And so we've created a UAS test range out there. So we sit here with the Air Force in the Air Force airspace, and we're working through the procedures to work with the Air Force, work with the FAA, in order to fly these UASs in this back 40. Our goal is to expand that and work through the safety risks and the mitigations associated with that to the point that we will be able to fly routine UAS operations on our campus to deliver the mail, to potentially survey the buildings, right? We currently are working with folks to some of our GIS folks who want to look at the sides of the buildings and looks for cracks in the concrete or look at the pipes or that. So we are currently in the process of turning our own NASA Langley campus into a UAS test environment. So we would have to learn how to do the see and avoid. We'd have to understand how to do the communication, how to do the local
simple navigation
around
buildings and different levels and wires. And
the one thing I will say, in all of our times of dealing with the SR-22 and dealing with UASs, you're going to lose link with these aircraft. They're going to be disrupted at some point. So one of the things that we're working on is how do you safely land a vehicle that's in trouble? Where do you land that vehicle? We don't want everybody walking around having to wear hard hats here, right? So the idea is to make sure that we can work in our environment safely and have UASs operating around us.
NASA's shooting for shirt sleeves and UASs, like they shot for shirt sleeves in space.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very, very cool.
So it actually brings up one of the other projects we did a few years ago on SR. We actually took and had on the phone terrain avoidance software. So what does a pilot do? So when we start talking about drones and them operating around people, and we start talking about autonomy and how all of that is going to work together. Well, if you think about a pilot today, what does he do when he's sitting in the cockpit? He's aviating, he's navigating, and he's communicating, right? The aviating includes avoiding hazards, right? Avoiding trees, avoiding terrain, avoiding weather, avoiding other traffic. So we have to program those functions into the aircraft. And then on top of it, right, we want to create behaviors, good behaviors. When we were in North Dakota, one of the we were flying the algorithms, and we were flying one aircraft at the other, and then the one aircraft maneuvered. But the way the aircraft maneuvered is he full throttled and flew fast enough to get in front of the other aircraft in order to avoid hitting it. The pilot said, you know, the right behavior, the good behavior, would have been to slow down and fly behind him. So he never even saw you. So one of the other things that's really part of the art of autonomy here is how do you program the behaviors into...
How do you program the unpredictability of human beings? I have a bad analogy there are two types of UAV flyers that we don't like. I don't like dumb and I don't like stupid. Dumb right. is people who don't know any better and do something that you can teach them, right? Stupid is somebody who does something deliberate and I always say I can't fix stupid. I can train someone not to fly near an airport, but someone who wants to deliberately fly near an airport, I can't fix that.
Right. And then one of the other things that folks are working on here as well is there are technologies that we're funding to stay out zones, right? So drones that you don't want them flying over certain areas, right? You don't want them flying over a backyard of somebody if they don't need to be. So create the technology that enables you to keep UASs out of certain areas. Geofencing is another term we're using these days, where you create the fence that you want the drone to stay inside of, right? This is your path. Don't go outside of it. We are looking at numerous technologies like that here at the center.
I appreciate you taking the time, Frank. It's been fantastic. And what NASA is doing is vitally important to the industry. I mean, it's setting the standards for everybody else. So the FAA can think cohesively and industry can make standards that for everybody to fly safely, which is really what we want navigating in the UAS. So thank you for being on UAV Digest, and I hope we can follow up a little bit later, and not necessarily 5 years, on what the SR-22's been doing. So yeah. Thank you very much.
Sure. There's one piece of, if you don't mind, I'd like to add to your last statement that made me think about it. When flying UASs one of the difficult problems that the whole community has, right? I mean, is figuring out all of the different rules that UASs have to fly under. And that's the reason it's been so long. One of the reasons it's been so long is because there's a lot of issues that have to get resolved before we can just let UASs go fly in congested areas, right? How much training does the UAS operator have? Which airspace are we going to let him? Are we going to let him fly near an airport or not near an airport? And what qualifications does the pilot or the operator have to have? How reliable does that UAS have to be? Meaning, somebody on a normal aircraft with people on it, if that actually crashes, you have a fatality. One of the things about UASs that's different, right, is if a UAS crashes, there's a good chance that it's nothing more than the aircraft is destroyed. So we have to figure out how reliable all of those systems on there have to be. Just how reliable does it need to be to make sure we are safe enough to fly within the NAS, the National Airspace System. So part of this is the responsibility of the FAA working with the communities and NASA to do the research to say how safe we can be and making sure that we are safe enough that there are no fatalities.
Well, we got a ways to go, but we're hopefully in the right direction. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fascinating interview, David. Really interesting stuff.
Frank was very willing to talk, and he could have kept me talking all day long. He was very excited, and the conversation went on a lot longer. We actually went out to the main hangar, and since he's the deputy director, he got to take us out, and we got to hang out. I'm not supposed to say this, but we got to hang out with the F-22 Raptors that Langley decided to park. The Air Force decided to park in NASA's hangar. As well as I got to see their new C-130 that they're using for Earth, as well as some other projects that, unfortunately, because the Raptors were there, we weren't able to take pictures. But Frank was a great host, and I'd also like to thank Kathy, who is the public affairs, as well as Bill, our favorite NASA historian, for giving me the opportunity. And we'll have more from NASA because they liked us. So we're looking forward to more stuff coming, news from them, and to bring it to you. So thanks to NASA for the opportunity, and thanks for Max. And next time it's going to be your turn, Max, to go play with the toys.
I'm game. I'm all for it. Thank you, David. All right. We want to thank all of you for listening. This is been episode 149 of the UAV Digest. Find us at theuavdigest.com and show notes for this episode at theuavdigest.com/149.
So with that, I guess I'll say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.